We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. Lots to cover, as there always is, starting with City Council. Let's start out there.
Yeah. So this week, the City Council and the Mayor's Office took had some action going on funding for BIPOC communities. Earlier in the week, the City Council approved a bill to send $1 million to the Office for Civil Rights to hire 3 staff and begin the search for an outside organization that would take proposals for how to spend the $30 million that the Council allocated for the participatory budgeting process. Now, Mayor Durkan had wanted the Department of Neighborhoods to actually do all that work. And the Black Brilliance Project, on the other hand, had wanted the City Council to hire and organize a very large and expensive committee of community organizers to do it, which would have probably spent more than a third of that $30 million just to create the committee and to evaluate proposals. This having the Office of Civil Rights is the compromise proposal that the council felt that it could support. So it's still within a city department, but you know, the Office of Civil Rights has, I think, a better track record with communicating, to communities of color, to and with communities of color than the Department of Neighborhoods does. So, that's, I think, a plus and something that, both sides, the mayor's office and the researchers in the Black Brilliance Project could probably at least say, okay, yeah, we can support that. Now, later in the week, the mayor's handpicked Equitable Communities Initiative Task Force, it's a mouthful, had it announced on Thursday its recommendations on how to spend $30 million set aside in the city budget. Now, this is the remainder of that $100 million that Mayor Durkan had set aside, saying, oh, you know, the participatory budgeting process isn't necessary. I'll just allocate $100 million and set up my own handpicked task force to spend that money, you know, on what my, you know, handpicked task force determines are communities of need. Now, when the city council got their hands on the mayor's draft budget, they looked at that $100 million and said, what? You know, they immediately moved $30 million into the participatory budgeting fund, and then they restored $30 million that the mayor had raided from the Mercer Mega Block sale that had been originally earmarked for a strategic investment fund, but that the mayor had then taken that money and put it into her $100 million little kitty there that she was going to. Yeah, her little slush fund that she was going to try to direct. So that left, you know, after $10 million was moved for other purposes, that left $30 million in that originally $100 million slush fund. And so now the mayor's handpicked task force has made their recommendations on how that money should be spent. They've recommended that it should be divided into 4 equal pieces of $7.5 million each, and then they should be spent on the following 4 items. So the first item is funding and assistance for BIPOC businesses, essentially providing them, you know, help and strategic planning so that they don't fail at a higher rate than white-owned businesses, which has actually been the case historically. The second
particularly
item,
during the pandemic.
Yeah. The second item is equity and education funds for things like college readiness programs for students of color, training racially diverse teachers, reentry programs for formerly incarcerated folks, and cultural education programs in various institutions like museums and schools. And then the third item is housing and land acquisition program, including lease to buy programs and encouraging wealth building for members of the BIPOC community through home ownership and for the BIPOC community in general through land purchases and purchases of like community centers and things like that. And then the fourth item is health programs, including programs to train racially diverse healthcare workers and to address discrimination within the medical community and to provide culturally appropriate and specific healthcare programs for folks who maybe speak English as a second language and who are people of color. Now, the task force is working on drafting legislation that it hopes to present to the City Council in late June or early July. Of course, the City Council will have to sign off on these priorities, and then they'll have to sign off on a plan for and a timeline for taking proposals for how to spend that money, and on a structure for how and who in city government will be reviewing those proposals and then dispersing the funds. And then on Friday, the mayor finally announced a request for proposals for that other $30 million in the strategic investment fund that I just talked about. That was the money from the Mercer Mega Block sale that the mayor tried to raid and add to her slush fund, but that the city council restored when they did the budget. Those funds are supposed to be used to help communities at risk for high displacement purchase land and buildings for affordable housing and to help small businesses who are at risk of being displaced because of rising rents. Now, so the mayor finally on Friday said that, okay, city's going to accept proposals for this, even though, let's see, the year is what, almost half over, right? Mm-hmm. So each proposal can be set up, can be for up to $5 million a piece, and the city will prioritize funding to community groups, co-ops, community land trusts, and developers who are already working with or have a track record of working with community groups and co-ops and other affordable housing organizations. Now, a group of 19 people will, the mayor said, 19 handpicked people will review the proposals and decide who gets the funding. Now, this community advisory group includes people from various community organizations like One America, the Seattle Foundation, the Black Farmers Collective, Homesite, Lake City Collective, Chief Seattle Club, and many others. But, you know, they're kind of a who's who of mainstream liberal anti-poverty development organizations, the, you know, kind of the usual suspects that the city works with already. So not a lot of sort of very grassroots groups or very small community groups. They're sort of the bigger, more established ones, which is, you know, what we would expect Mayor Durkan to come up with. Now, the deadline to submit proposals is July 14th. And so there's about a little over a month for groups to put together proposals for funding. And the advisory group will make recommendations in August on those proposals, with the final decisions to be made in October, which I think is, I don't know, it's like when you allocate $30 million to spend in the city budget, and it takes the mayor to get around to starting the process of spending that money, it takes almost half the year, and then you finally disperse the funds, maybe get them all dispersed in October. To me, that's definitely foot dragging there.
It's also interesting timing, considering you've got elections coming up.
Yes, we have elections coming up then.
And how that's going to play with different initiatives and people who are running.
Different candidates. I'm thinking in terms of Casey Sixkiller, who is Mayor Durkan's deputy mayor, who's in charge of homelessness, that he might try to make hay out of, oh, look, you know, my work in the city government is helping to spend all this money for, you know, land acquisition for affordable housing, blah, 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 when it was actually the city council who restored that funding. The mayor would have cut it completely. And it's something that Lorena Gonzalez should rightfully claim, not Casey Sixkiller. So I think this may be the mayor's way of trying to help her preferred candidate.
Mm-hmm. Not that she would be Machiavellian in that way at all.
Job's a little more charitable than I am, I guess.
Yeah.
He just needs to wake up a little more.
Yeah. Yeah, the problem is that you can't do a sarcasm font on the radio, so.
Yeah.
All right. So, okay. Sticking with Mayor Durkin and Homes for People, she did an about-face this week on the homelessness outreach groups.
She did. She and the Human Services Department, the city backed down in the face of a fight with homelessness outreach groups. In May, the Human Services Department sent out revised contracts to homelessness outreach groups that included new, very controversial requirements, including that the groups be on call to do outreach at tent encampments that the city was targeting for sweeps, and that these groups do pretty onerous daily reporting to the city on results from their work at these tent encampment sweeps. Seven groups pushed back and refused to sign the contracts, including three groups who had formed explicitly to help homeless Native Americans and Pacific Islanders. They said that the requirements would conflict with their mission to serve a specific minority group or population and be a waste of their expertise. In addition, the prospect of Native American social workers pushing homeless Native Americans out of their tents and literally off that land would be traumatizing to both groups, which I think the city really had to say, people in the Human Services Department had to really be thinking, yeah, what's Mayor Durkin thinking, if she's thinking at all, you know? So this week, the city finally backed down and said that they would revise the contract so that these groups would not have to be on call to man encampment sweeps. But the city hasn't yet released revised wording or said what the details of the revised contracts will be. They're kind of in negotiations right now with these service providers. But those seven service providers are really sticking to their guns and saying, we're not going to sign the contract with these specific provisions in them. So groups like the Indian Health Board, Chief Seattle Club, REACH, and the Downtown Emergency Services Center are saying that they are just not willing to become the new navigation team, essentially, and that that's not what they had hoped that the HOPE team would become. You can, and I just have to say, when the navigation team was cut by the city council and the new HOPE team was negotiated by City Council Member Andrew Lewis and members of the Human Service Department and these community outreach organizations, they had a vision of what they thought it would be, and they negotiated a new approach. But I can tell you, if the same old people in city government are still in charge in the mayor's office and in the Human Services Department, and all they really understand is sweeping homeless encampments, then that's what the new approach is. The new approach is just going to look eventually a lot like the old approach, right?
Mm-hmm. And they, are doing more sweeps as we speak.
Oh, yeah. Getting ready for the tourist season, essentially, and for businesses reopening. And that means pushing homeless people to be more – try to be more invisible by just kind of harassing them and shoving them around the city. Mm.
Okay. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Well, there was a big decision this week regarding the payroll tax.
Yeah. Last summer, the city council approved a new payroll tax, the Jumpstart payroll tax, that employers would pay if they have at least $7 million in payroll and at least one employee working inside the Seattle city limits who makes more than $150,000. The tax rate is 0.7% on amounts above $150,000 per employee. And there is a higher tier for businesses with $1 billion or more in payroll that is double that.
That begin with the letter A.
Yeah, it's 1.4%, and essentially Amazon would probably be the only business in Seattle that would meet that higher tier. Now, the council estimated that the top 1% of Seattle businesses would pay the 0.7% tax. And as Java and I said, probably the only employer paying the 1.4% tax would be Amazon. Now, the Seattle Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce promptly sued the city in King County Superior Court, claiming that this was a tax on an employee's right to earn a living. And this week, King County Superior Court Judge Mary Roberts disagreed with the Chamber of Commerce, and she sided with the city. She pointed out that the tax is on employers only, and the law specifically prohibits employers from passing it through or withholding the tax from their employees' paychecks. Now, while
I love this decision because it is essentially, yes, the city has the right to tax businesses. This is something, of course, that Amazon probably disagrees with, but yes, the city does have the right to tax businesses, and it really should try it more often, and not just small businesses.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Now, in this case, it's targeting specifically businesses that are probably enormously profitable if they can afford to pay their employees over $150,000. It's also a little bit of a high income earners tax in a way, because essentially it's giving businesses the signal that maybe you ought to be a little more equitable in how you pay all of your employees. If you have a few employees who make extremely high salaries over $150,000, and you have many, many, many employees who you're paying at minimum wage, well, maybe you ought to rethink that formula. And if you did, you'd avoid paying the tax. So in a way, it's not a bad idea to target a payroll tax and write it in the way that the city did. And I believe Shama Sawant was one of the main drivers behind pushing for that kind of a tax. But the Jumpstart payroll tax was crafted by Teresa Mosqueda, and she actually consulted with some of the more progressive businesses in the city of Seattle to try to craft a tax that they thought would be a good one, that would not be onerous for small businesses, or that would affect a business's ability to hire people in the city of Seattle. So now the Chamber of Commerce may decide to appeal this decision. I don't think they really have much of a case here, and Judge Roberts' decision was pretty clear on that. So this was very good news for the city council and the city budget, which assumes that the payroll tax will go into effect as of January this year, with the first tax returns to be filed and payments to be made by January 31st of next year. Kind of like you file and pay your personal income taxes on the previous year income by April of the next year. For businesses, this would be by January 31st of the next year. So that's all I have on that.
Okay. Well, moving on, developments this week regarding the, say missing texts, but they're really deleted texts.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Seattle Times filed multiple, the Seattle Times is suing the city over Mayor Durkin's missing text messages. And the Seattle Times filed multiple FOIA Freedom of Information Act requests last summer to get the emails and text messages of upper-level city employees during the George Floyd protests and the formation of the CHOP, the Capitol Hill Organized Protest Zone. In particular, they were trying to get answers to the questions of who ordered that the East Precinct be abandoned and who was responsible for tear gassing peaceful protesters. So they were trying to figure out, you know, who made those decisions. Right. What the city legal department is saying now is that Mayor is that Mayor Durkan was using a cell phone that automatically deleted text messages older than 30 days, which would be a clear violation of the State Public Records Act and the city's own policies on record retention. At least that's what they're saying, right? Mm-hmm. And so far they haven't, explained why text messages are also missing for at least seven other upper level city officials, including former police chief Carmen Best. Okay. That seems like
they got one of those, you know, 6-for-1 deals on smartphones.
Right. So I'm not buying it. So the Seattle Times went to court this week because clearly they're not buying it either. And they filed a lawsuit against the city and King County Superior Court alleging willful violation of the Public Records Act. Now, this includes the fact that text messages were being deleted even after the Seattle Times had filed their original FOIA request last summer, and the city's legal department was in the process of reviewing those requests. The deletion was continuing at that point.
Oh, picky detail.
Yeah. Now, the Times has won similar lawsuits against the city of Seattle, including one as recently as 2019. Just 2 years ago, which required all staff inside the mayor's office, okay, all staff in the mayor's office, to get training on what records must be preserved under state law and how to do that. Now, that was barely 1 year before the alleged violations occurred. So I think part of the reason the Seattle Times is suing is not just because they want to punish Mayor Durkan or the folks or the IT folks working under her or whatever, or the legal department for deleting stuff they shouldn't have deleted, but because they want the city to undergo some kind of structured change that ensures that these kinds of communications are preserved, because just suing and getting a judgment hasn't worked in the past. I'm guessing they're going to ask for the judge to require some kind of plan for the city to undergo in order to preserve this kind of digital public record.
I would suggest one of the major tenets of that plan should be getting a new mayor.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Some competent people in the city legal department as well would probably help.
That would be a bonus. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Well, and being on the outside of it, you never know whether it's an issue of competence or if it's more than likely a power dynamics issue.
Yeah, well,
I think it's more likely that, yes.
The legal department has told the Seattle Times that they're trying to accumulate the saved text messages on other city staffers' phones to reconstruct what text messages the mayor may have sent. You know, they can't necessarily received. They may not be able to reconstruct all of them, but they can certainly reconstruct quite a bit of that history. It's just that they have not released any of that yet either. So that's probably will be part of the lawsuit too, is how long should a FOIA request be outstanding? How long should the city have in order to actually respond to something that is newsworthy and that is important and that the public has a right to know? You know, can they drag their feet for 3 years trying to reconstruct lost text messages?
Yeah.
Or do they need to put more resources to that?
Well, and also, why doesn't a representative of the city pursue getting that data from the actual carriers, like AT&T or whatever, instead of, you know, going through individuals at the city level to get it? I mean, if this was a criminal activity that the feds were interested in, you know that they'd be going through the tech companies to get the info.
Yeah, but I think we need a warrant and a judicial sign off on that.
Probably, yeah,
but
in which case, you know, the lawsuit might be a way to get that go that route.
Mm. Yeah, so we'll see as the lawsuit moves through what sanctions the Seattle Times requests other than just getting access to those text messages or asking the judge to find the city.
Looking forward to the discovery process.
It'll be fun.
Yep.
All right. Okay, moving on to developments this week with the pandemic. COVID.
Yeah. We now have the shot of a lifetime. Washington State has entered the trend of states around the country to offer incentives for people to get out and vaccinated. The way the Washington State program is set up, anybody who has previously gotten a shot is automatically entered through the state's database of shots administered. And, you know, this is kind of odd because it isn't really an incentive if you're rewarding people for behavior they've already engaged in. But unless you're, you know, worried that they might not want booster shots later. But in any event, the grand prize is $1 million, and there are a bunch of smaller prizes. The total kitty is worth over $2 million. And this is to respond to the declining vaccination rates both around the state and around the country, and particularly in eastern Washington, where some counties have lower vaccination rates. King County has a relatively high vaccination rate, but, you know, you're still looking at, you know, large numbers of people who have not been vaccinated. And we saw those last weekend over Memorial Day with people crowding Alki Beach. Basically a flash mob that had to be shut down by police last Saturday night. So, you know, people are behaving as if the pandemic is over, and it is not over. You're still seeing nearly 200 new cases a day in King County. That is not nearly as bad as it was, say, in January, but it ain't over yet. So, you know, it's we keep saying this every week, just, you know, be self-disciplined, be cautious. There's still plenty of people, including kids, immunocompromised, et cetera, who are not protected, and they rely on you.
So the some of the numbers from the King County Department of Public Health are that new infection rates are still about 150 to 200 per day in King County, new cases per day. Hospitalizations are averaging about a dozen per day, some days higher than that, some days a little lower. And about 2 to 4 people per day are dying. Okay, and that's too many. Too many now that we have a vaccine. Vaccinations are continuing. It's at 76.2% of the King County population has received one dose, and 67%. Just right at 2/3 of the population are fully vaccinated, which is good. But the bad news is that the vaccination rate has dropped from a high of 42,000 doses per day in late April to less than 10,000 doses per day now. And there's still over 500,000 King County residents over age 16 who haven't completed their vaccinations, including, get this, over 456,000 who haven't even had one shot yet. Those are adults over age 16. Okay, so that's not good. And, you know, we often hear that we'll have herd immunity when 70% of the total population has been vaccinated. But, you know, the herd immunity level differs for each disease based on a number of factors, including how communicable the disease is or how easily it spreads. For a similar virus like whooping cough or measles, which are also airborne and can be highly contagious, just like COVID-19. Herd immunity is only reached when 92 to 94% of a population is vaccinated. When you fall below that level, it starts to spread, and those diseases can spread to even vaccinated people when you get below that 92% to 94% herd immunity level. So, and I just want to remind people, in King County, about 20% of our population is under age 18, okay? So really, every single adult has to get vaccinated, with no exceptions, even if you've already had the virus, because you can get reinfected. And kids over age 12 can now get the vaccine, and they really must get it too, which means parents have to step up and get their kid scheduled to get a dose of their two doses of the Pfizer vaccine. Not to hesitate and say, oh, you know, these are untested. I think at this point, with the millions of people who have gotten all three of these vaccines, the Pfizer, Moderna, and the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, there's no way you can argue these vaccines are untested, okay?
Yeah, there's 6 months of real-world data on these vaccines now.
Yeah,
And shows they are remarkably effective and remarkably safe.
Remarkably safe, even compared to other vaccines that people routinely get for their youngest children. And really, I just want to point out, I don't know where the 70% herd immunity number came from, but I don't think it's even close to being accurate in this case. What we need to do is assume at least 90% and then reach for a 95% goal.
If you ask actual epidemiologists, they'll tell you 70 to 90, and 90 is a lot safer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so to reach that 90 to 95% goal, every adult, every child over 12 has to get the shot, has to get the shots if it's Pfizer and Moderna, has to get the shot if it's Johnson & Johnson.
And remember, you're not fully protected until a couple weeks after that second shot.
Right. So don't just get your arm stuck and then a couple days later go out and party at Alki. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. So. Nationally, we're seeing more and more of these incentive programs that different states often are tying to state lotteries. My favorite so far, and I use quotes around that word favorite, is West Virginia, where they are offering hunting rifles as one of the prizes. Now, gun violence is already considered a public health crisis in this country, so why you're contributing to one public health crisis in order to alleviate another kind of escapes me. I think the messaging is at best muddled there. But you're seeing these $1 to $2 million prizes in states around the country. Ohio, California, New Mexico, a lot of different states are taking this under. We're not really seeing a lot of that though in southern states, which is where the vaccination rate is lowest. Mississippi, it's only 31% are fully vaccinated, compared to nearly double that in a number of northeastern states, and Washington State is approaching that. Similarly, Alabama is low, Texas is low, et cetera, et cetera. States across the Old South have been very slow in their vaccine rollout, and some of this is vaccine hesitancy. Some of it is the lack of access by communities of color, particularly in the rural Deep South, where they tend to have large African American communities that do not have easy access to, say, pharmacies or healthcare clinics. And of course, you know, the privatization of hospitals over the last decade has meant that a lot of rural hospitals in a lot of parts of the country have closed. So it can be, you know, a long ways to get to the nearest hospital. These really point up, problems with healthcare access in the healthcare system in this country. And, at the same time, it's been remarkable that as many people have been vaccinated as quickly as they have. Worldwide, we've now seen 2 billion shots administered in 6 months, which is truly remarkable. But again, globally also, there's really a lack of equity, where wealthy countries have seen very high vaccination rates, and some of the poorer countries, such as in Africa and Southeast Asia, have seen relatively low vaccination rates. So that is something that WHO is trying to work on. We saw the United States commit to making another tranche of doses available to the WHO's COVAX program to try and distribute those to poorer countries. But until you have until you have equitable distribution of vaccines around the world, the virus is just going to keep circulating. And it's going to be very difficult to eradicate anywhere in the world just because the world is so interconnected at this point. And that's not even talking about variants, which there's several really concerning ones going on right now.
We'll talk about those.
We will.
No, I mean, talk about those now.
Oh, okay, sure.
Just while we're on the subject.
So the WHO has decided to rename the variant. So in place of the rather confusing alphanumeric systems that scientists have been using, they're now simply Greek letters. So, for instance, the first well-known one, which was the one from Britain, is known as the Alpha variant. The one in India that has swept through much of Asia is now the Delta variant. And the most concerning new one is out of Brazil. That's the second Brazilian one. That is the Gamma variant. And that is the one that's killing a disproportionate number of toddlers and young children. And that is something that, that particular variant is also getting a foothold in the United States. So that's one to keep an eye on as well.
Particularly worrisome because, you know, the youngest children in our population are not eligible for a vaccine yet. And if their parents are not getting vaccinated and their siblings or they are going to school, that puts them at a pretty high risk if that variant gets a foothold here.
It's also very concerning because scientists have not been able to figure out why exactly, what the actual medical mechanism is that it's targeting young kids in that way. But the number of young kids who have died in Brazil is all out of proportion to anywhere else in the world, and it's strictly because of that variant.
Mm. Yeah, and I would say in terms of the Brazilian healthcare infrastructure, we're not talking about a country that has, you know, very little healthcare infrastructure. I'm guessing it is an issue with the variant and not an issue with Brazil's inability to treat those children.
Yeah, although the pandemic has been so bad in Brazil that it has often overwhelmed their healthcare system. But yes, that is true. It's not one of the most impoverished countries in the world, put it that way.
Well, the WHO rebranding the variants just seems bizarre to me. It's not going to help me remember which variant we're talking about. I mean, we've been, you know, inundated with this stuff for, you know, months, if not a year now.
I think it's an effort to try to not stigmatize nations that have had these variants arise, whether that's Britain or Brazil or India or Vietnam or whatever. They're, you know, trying not to lean into the Trump habit of calling it the China virus, you know?
Yep.
And I kind of get that. On the other hand, I'm not sure Alpha, Delta, Gamma is very memorable. You know, maybe find some other way to label them.
Well, and also you need to have something that works across different languages. So for that reason, the Greek letters make a certain amount of sense.
That's true.
All right. Okay. Anything else on?
No, we got plenty of national to cover, and I think no time left.
Well, we still got 20 minutes, so.
We got some
time. Okay. Oh, you're right. Sorry.
We have a lot of international too, so.
Yes, we do.
Okay, so nationally, what would you like to start with?
I would mention that there was another police shooting in Minneapolis on Thursday night. U.S. Marshals shot a guy named Winston Boogie Smith, who they were trying to arrest for a felony gun violation, and shot him in his parked car. And there have been protests in Minneapolis the last couple of nights, so keeping an eye on that one. No video footage of that has yet emerged, but you know the Put it this way, Minneapolis's trust of law enforcement is not very high right now. They're not really getting the benefit of the doubt on that one. Speaking of the law enforcement, Donald Trump is in trouble again this week. He did not have a very good week. He saw the controller for the Trump Organization called to testify before the grand jury, and his former White House attorney, Don McGahn, after 2 years, finally responded to a subpoena and testified before a congressional committee this week. So, the truth is coming out, and I think Donald Trump is in a lot of trouble legally. We'll see where it goes. It's going to be an interesting summer.
All right. Anything else on that?
Remember the grand jury in New York is a function of the Manhattan DA, and there is a primary coming up later this month, at which they will begin to elect a new DA. So keep an eye on that also, because that may impact the process.
Okay. jump to international. Want to talk about the G7?
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the tax agreement. The G7 this week, the very end of the week, and just hit the news cycle this morning, came to an agreement on a minimum 15% corporate tax rate for global corporate taxes. The G7 are the U.S., Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the U.K.
Notice Russia is not in there.
Russia's not in there, no. So the agreement said that, and they were particularly, the U.S. was particularly focusing on tech companies, which have a record moving their international operations to a tax haven that where they can either pay zero tax or the very lowest tax rate they can find. And so they were focused on taxing tech companies, but the other members of the G7 were uncomfortable with just targeting tech companies, and they expanded it to include a broader range of global corporations. The next step, of course, is to get the G20, a bigger group, from the G7, to agree at their meeting in July in Italy to the same tax rate. Now, that's going to be a harder thing to do because the G20 will include other European countries like Ireland, who has one of the lowest corporate tax havens in the world, is a corporate tax haven who has one of the lowest corporate tax rates at 12.5%. And they're going to resist raising that rate as much as they can because it has, having that lower rate has allowed them to host the operations of many tech companies, including Apple and Amazon. And has been a big boost for the Irish economy. So that's going to be a big hurdle for this. And here in the United States, there's another hurdle because any global treaty that the United States wants to ratify has to be passed by the Senate with a two-thirds majority. And currently, the Democrats don't have a two-thirds majority in the Senate, and global corporate tax rate is not very popular with the Republican Party. Let's just say that.
It has the word tax in it.
Yeah, it has the word tax in it. And the Republican Party's mantra is no taxes, which is ridiculous. No taxes ever, which is ridiculous. But that is their position. And of course, Joe Biden is trying to push an effort to raise the U.S. corporate tax rate from 21% to 28%. But if the global rate is 15%, then, that's not going to necessarily slow the movement of large corporations who are locating a lot more of their operations abroad to try to avoid higher taxes in the United States. So really the 15% global tax rate has to be viewed as just a first step, a small first step towards a system of parity worldwide where corporations do actually pay the same rate in every country.
Yeah, and they're trying to, you know, head off the whole race to the bottom that has characterized the global economy really for the last 40 years.
Yeah. Now, the history of what the average tax rate for corporations has been is, if you look back, the average global corporate tax rate was 40% in 1980, just before the Reagan era. And then since the Reagan era and the Bill Clinton era, where a lot of deregulation happened, and then during the time of the George W. Bush administration and the Trump administration, when taxes fell even further, the average global corporate tax rate in 2020 was 23%. So it's fallen almost by half in that time.
Yeah, I didn't pull that 40-year figure out of my butt. That was not an accident.
Yeah. So
goes back to Reagan.
Yeah. So average corporate tax rate has been much higher in the past, and right now 23% is the average tax rate. So proposing a 15% global tax rate seems like an easy lift, right? And in fact, maybe even a cut from what corporations pay now. So I think it has to just be a first baby step towards getting parity and getting corporations to pay what they really should in order to contribute to the functioning of the global economy.
So, and it appears to be in sync with the $15 an hour movement. Using the 15 again, you know, very
using
popular number.
Again. Yeah. Yeah, well, I think it's really an effort to try to get countries like Ireland to sign on, you know, because they have such a low tax rate, 12.5%. Moving it to 15 shouldn't be hard for them, but we'll see if that works coming in July when the G20 meets.
So is the G7 essentially just a committee for the G20?
It's the biggest, yeah, you know, you start with the smallest group of countries, some of the biggest nations in the world in terms of the size of their economies, try to get them to agree, and then you have to try to get buy-in by the smaller nations. So, you know, it's kind of a stepped process, the G7, then the G20, and then you take it to the broader bodies.
Gotcha.
The bigger bodies like the UN.
All right. Okay, anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Well, there was news, it was actually about 2 weeks ago, about a couple hundred bodies found up in just north of us.
Yeah, that was that actually was announced a week ago yesterday. The Indian Residential School in Kamloops, which is the largest Indian residential school in Canada, and this was a system whereby white folks took Indians' kids away from them, First Nations, in order to assimilate and civilize them. These schools were often run by religious orders, and 215 bodies of Native children were found buried underneath one of the residential schools up in Kamloops, just north of the Okanagan. And
in a large unmarked grave.
Yeah, and this is something that was not a surprise to First Nations groups up there. They had long suspected this. They had talked openly about kids disappearing and never being spoken of or heard of again. But it is really forcing a reckoning of one of the more uglier facets of Canadian racism. Canada has its own racist history, which is a little bit different, but not that different from American racism. The First Nations issues up there are much more pronounced than Native issues in the United States, because the percentage of people who are First Nations are much larger, particularly in northern Canada. This is something that is now, you know, basically forcing a reexamination of, do we need to start looking at every old residential school in Canada, because there were a lot of them, particularly in BC and Alberta. Yeah, so that's
we had him here as well. I remember knowing people when I was young here in Washington State who had grown up in residential schools. And I remember being shocked by that. Knowing people my age or a little bit older who said, yes, I was taken away from my parents. I don't even know who they were.
Wow.
You know, I was literally raised in a residential school. And that's not just an effort to kind of indoctrinate kids. It's an attempt to really destroy a culture because you're separating the youth from an entire community, and you're denying them access to the history, the language, the culture, not just to their the connection, the sort of warm connection that children have with their parents and their other family members.
And the extended family, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's really an effort to destroy that culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with some degree of success, I might add. And, you know, at these residential schools, it wasn't just kids dying. There was also a lot of sexual abuse, a lot of physical abuse. These kids were treated as, you know, disposable playthings, basically, by the state. And it was a horrific story. Mm-hmm. And yes, we're not immune to that history in this country either.
No. Clearly, yeah. We need to be reexamining that.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, often when we talk about the genocide of Native Americans, where, you know, people think about the, you know, sort of Indian wars that were conducted by the U.S. military against Native Americans in the 1800s. You know, or we think about the violation of treaty rights or the displacement of tribes from the land that mostly occurred in the 1800s. We don't think about these 19th century or these 20th century things like the forcing kids away from their parents and their families, you know, forcing youth to not speak their native languages, things like that. And in the case that this brings forward, physical abuse, absolute neglect. So they were saying that a number of these children were malnourished. So not only stealing kids from their parents, but not feeding them enough so that they could survive a bout with the flu or the measles. And a lot of them died. And instead of telling the families, at least giving back the bodies of their children, just dumping them in a mass unmarked grave. Just pretty horrific. So, and these are things that happened up through the 1950s, 1960s, the 1970s in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. recent history.
Exactly.
Yeah. And people alive now who survived that system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Okay, so pretty grim topic, I know.
Yeah, that was our feel good topic for the day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, let's move on Nigeria.
Nigeria has indefinitely suspended Twitter. There is no Twitter access anywhere in the country now. And the reason for this will sound familiar to somebody.
Sounds like heaven. Sorry.
Yes, it was meant as punishment. And the reason was that somebody on Twitter insulted the president of Nigeria. this is something that there may be a lesson for future Republican tyrants.
I'm shocked. I'm shocked.
Yeah, I know. This is you know, modern global media, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's not a very good precedent, obviously, but I mean, it's a wonderful precedent if you don't like Twitter, but this is something to keep an eye on because once again, you know, Nigeria is one of these countries where there is a authoritarian regime and an active resistance movement that the government is trying to silence by denying access to social media. So we'll keep an eye on that one. And hope that the idea doesn't spread. We have seen, suspension of Twitter during, coup attempts or mass unrest in places like Turkey and Egypt in the past. This, however, was more or less during peacetime. So it's another step in that direction, where we're seeing,
China's lockdown on social media when they feel the need to do it.
China is much more systematic. That's kind of a special case because they literally can monitor the social media use of all 1.5 billion people in the country. They track it at all times. It's really quite Orwellian. And very creepy system they have there.
You mean a little bit like we have here?
No, not really.
with the NSA.
Well, yeah. But you know, you don't get you and I don't get knocks on the doors after a program like this.
Oh, yeah, true.
And anybody accessing the podcast does not get a knock on the door. That's what happens in China.
Yeah,
or they're just disappeared. It's not a good system. But yeah, it shows you what technology can do. That's for sure.
Yeah, and it's tangential to that. I saw an article today about the FBI has put in a request with Gannett, which owns USA Today, asking for the IP addresses for everyone that accessed an article regarding two FBI agents who had been shot and killed during a raid. Basically asked for every IP address and location that occurred in a 35-minute period of people who clicked on an article.
That's not tangential.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I would hope that would be litigated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, again, it's fighting it currently, but just the fact that they asked for that and that's business as usual.
With the expectation that they would get it.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't ask for it if you think you won't get it.
Right.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And the only reason we know about it is because, you know, they finally came forward with it. But a lot of times even them making those requests, the law protects that information from coming out to the public, you know, until somebody leaks it or somebody puts up a fight in court. So,
or a whistleblower leaks it.
Yeah. So we're not that far behind in China.
Yeah. In terms of, it's just the follow up. Isn't quite the same.
Right. Right.
That we know of. Yeah.
Exactly. So, well, we are pretty much out of time for this week, but luckily we'll have an hour together next week where we can share more stories.
Yes. Well, lucky for our listeners. So, all right. Well, we'll see you next week.
All right.
Yeah. I'll see you next week.